Are you thirsty? The American writer Samuel Clemens, who is actually better known as Mark Twain, wrote once that he was very tired of all the discord that he saw in the world. He wrote, "So I built myself a cage, and in it I put a dog and a cat. After a little training, I got the dog and the cat to the point where they lived peaceably together. Then I introduced a pig, a goat, a kangaroo, some birds, and a monkey. And after a few adjustments, they all learned to live in harmony together in that cage. So encouraged was I by the success that I added an Irish Catholic, a Presbyterian, a Jewish person, a Muslim from Turkestan, a Buddhist from China, and along with that, a Baptist missionary I had captured on one of my trips. In a very short while, there wasn't a single living thing in that cage." Now, as humorous as this piece by Mark Twain is, it's also sadly reflective of our world, isn't it? I know I'm not alone in my assessment that something disturbing, something quite sinister has been building in our world. Tensions created by differences that people have always been present, but it seems that those who promote bias and hatred and xenophobia are becoming much bolder. How else do you explain the growing power of the far-right movement in the United States and in many parts of Europe? Or the racial discrimination being exercised by the American government in the guise of national security? But Canada's not alone in this, or Canada's not innocent in any of this. I don't know if you remember a few years back, Saudi Arabia, which is one of the worst human rights offenders on the planet, that treats its women very badly and also persecutes religious minorities, got from us, our government, our contractors, the delivery of 1,000 armored military vehicles, which cost $15 billion to the Saudis. In the meantime, those armored cars were used as part of Saudi's bombing campaign of Yemen that has killed thousands of people, has left 3 million people acutely malnourished, out of which 450,000 plus children are at risk of dying from malnutrition. And this is just one example of the sectarian-driven violence that's going on all over the world that's really messing things up. When the passage of John 4 came up in our service schedule, I could have taken a lot of different tracks trying to preach on this. But then I realized that before us today is Jesus' approach to ethnic and religious differences. When confronting isolationist policies and feeling fearful of those who espouse different ideas and beliefs than we do, we have John 4 to the answer of what would Jesus do? And what Jesus does in John 4 rocked his disciples to their very core. It challenged contemporary Jewish religious leaders, and it walked straight head on into an ancient cultural conflict. It all began that when we read that Jesus wanted to go back to his home territory of Galilee from Judea, and he decided to take the most direct route. In other words, to go through Samaria. We need to stop right there. Jesus and his disciples went through Samaria. Samaria. No good Jew in Jesus' day would ever willingly go into Samaria. Ever. Traveling from Judea to Galilee, people would take the long way around to avoid Samaria. Now, although Jews and Samaritans shared many beliefs and much of the same ancient history, they despised each other. Do you remember that famous, beloved parable of the Good Samaritan? I'm sure you do. Anyone who heard Jesus tell that parable that first day would be very confused, probably offended, that the Samaritan was being portrayed as the one who was pious and kind. It seems odd to us because the Jews and the Samaritans have a shared history, but believe it or not, the hated Romans were often more accepted in a Jewish society than Samaritans. The Roman centurion who had the sick servant in Matthew 8 is just one example. Samaritans, though, to Jews were considered an embarrassment. Jews didn't want Samaritans just out of their sight. They wanted them wiped from the earth. So again, I point out to you how shocking this trip by Jesus is as he goes into Samaria. I can imagine that the disciples would have had knots in their stomachs that intensified with each step they took into that territory. And then, Jesus causes further embarrassment for his disciples. He stops at Jacob's well and he talks to a Samaritan woman. Now, it's bad enough to walk through this territory, but to actually stop and talk to someone, a woman, at all that, his disciples were beside themselves. So you begin to wonder, where did all this animosity come from? By the way, just so you know, there are still Samaritans today, but they're a very small group. About 650 or so people declare themselves as Samaritans. Well, the woman at the well points to the very heart of the matter between Jews and Samaritans when she says to Jesus, who is a Jew, which was probably a very rare sight in her village, "Are you greater than our father Jacob who gave us this well?" And Jacob, as you know, was a renowned person in Jewish history. He was the one that was later renamed Israel. He had 12 sons, didn't he? And became the 12 tribes of Israel. The Samaritans were named, of course, for that famous Old Testament city called Samaria. It was the home of the northern kingdom. Samaritans generally believed that they were the descendants of Joseph and Levi, while those who were down in the southern kingdom considered themselves to be descendants of Judah, Benjamin, and maybe Levi as well. Even though both kingdoms of Israel came from the same forefather, Jacob, scholars know that several cultural and religious differences began to grow between these two groups. Even when David was on the throne of Judah in the United Kingdom, Samaria was a great thorn in his side. Rebellion and civil war often came from Samaria. The Assyrians, for their part, spent 20 years conquering Israel, and when it was finally conquered, all the land was lost except Samaria and the surrounding territory. The Assyrians took a lot of people into captivity, replaced them with foreign groups, and so the Samaritans began to intermix with one another, with other groups. While Judah was in captivity in Babylon, the Samaritans decided they'd build their own temple because the one in Jerusalem was destroyed. So they went to Mount Gerizim and they built a brand new temple to God. When the Judeans returned to Jerusalem, that's recorded in the book of Nehemiah, by the way, they rebuilt that temple in Jerusalem. And thus, a centuries-old squabble and fight began over which temple was the right one. So we have two groups that read the Torah, two groups that worship God, but they did not share a recent history at the time Jesus walks into that village. Their fight really was not about religious differences, but rather it was all about who were the true descendants of Jacob. Near the end of the 2nd century BC, the Jews destroyed that temple on Mount Gerizim, led by a Maccabean ruler. He also went in and he conquered all the Samaritans. So when Jesus walks into that village and sits at that well, he walked into the bitterness and hundreds of years of hatred and prejudice. When Jesus asked the woman for a drink of water, notice that she's shocked. And she's indignant too. Why would a Jew ask a Samaritan for anything, let alone some water? On the basis of the fact that Jesus and this woman are from differing factions of religious life. And that she's an unaccompanied woman should have been enough to prevent any interaction between Jesus and this woman. But you know what? Jesus has still got more taboos to reveal to us. Knowing full well the woman's life situation, he tells her, go get your husband and come back, because culturally she shouldn't be talking to a man without a male relative present. But Jesus asks her that because he wants to reveal something, wants something acknowledged. She replies that she has no husband. And Jesus states that she had answered correctly, and actually she's had five husbands and currently is living with a man who's not her husband. Jesus had revealed her secret and also shone light on another reason Jesus should never have talked to her in the first place. She was a social outcast. Why does she come to the well at noon and not early in the morning? You see, water was collected at that time of history in the early morning when it was cool. And the women of the village would come out at the same time to socialize and swap news. This woman Jesus meets is a social pariah. She is a shunned woman. She was likely the topic of much of that conversation that happened around the well. Hers was a horribly hard life. By all definition, she was, in the Jewish mind, unworthy of any attention at all. Hence the reaction of the disciples in verse 27. They were astonished that he was talking to this woman. The revelation of her life situation floors the woman, who discerns that Jesus must be a prophet, but then Jesus does something he rarely does. Often in the Gospels, Jesus tells people that he heals not to tell anyone what happened. He also uses throughout the Gospels the term Son of Man instead of Son of God, but here to this Samaritan woman, Jesus clearly identifies himself as the Messiah. The one who both Jews and Samaritans have been looking for and waiting for. The woman immediately runs off. She tells her fellow villagers all about Jesus, that this one could be the Messiah. And the people rush out to see Jesus. We have this beautiful scene of Jesus looking down from the well into the valley and all those villagers streaming towards him. And he declares what? Look how the fields are ripe for harvest. We read that Jesus stayed two more days, again a taboo, and teaches them, and many of the people of that village come to faith. This whole beautiful story is about something, it tells us something about the nature of the gospel and Jesus himself. Jesus knowingly and willingly goes to the heart of the Samaritan people and the people hated by his own people. The hatred was ingrained in their culture. Jesus also goes to a woman who should have been just cast aside by any pious Jew, someone who was irredeemable, as lost and beyond all hope. This passage reminds me that the message of God's love and salvation is never, ever limited by our prejudices. Jesus revealed himself to a woman whose past maybe we couldn't accept. It tells me that any argument about which group possesses the place where God truly worships is absolutely meaningless. Jesus offers a grace that transcends the things that we think divide us. May I dare go so far as to suggest that God is offended by our ever thinking that any other person is unworthy of God's love and forgiveness. It's presumptuous to think we have the authority to determine to whom God extends his love. C.S. Lewis wrote once about the scandal of grace. In commenting on this chapter, he stated that the offer of salvation to the Samaritans was offensive to his disciples. Lewis continues that no Christian teaching is more offensive to our sense of fairness and forgiveness and our sense of fairness than forgiveness. Grace is given to those who need the friend or enemy alike. God's all about tearing down walls. He's all about turning enemies into neighbors. Unfortunately, our world is very slow to adopt this same posture. And frankly, even we followers of Christ struggle sometimes to implement fully the grace that God wants to extend to this world. There are ample examples of the absurdity of what we think are critical example or critical differences between us. I came across a rather absurd story from the life of the famous movie personality Groucho Marx. Do you remember him? Maybe seen pictures of him? It seems that the daughter of famed comedian Groucho Marx was once denied admittance to an exclusive country club to go swimming with her friends there because the Marx family were not members of the club. Realizing what had happened, embarrassed officials of the club sent the Marx family an apology and also an application to join. And Grouch has declined the invitation with this comment: I wouldn't want to belong to any club that would have me as a member. Someone still tried to smooth over the incident by persuading the comedian to allow an application to be submitted for membership. But the country club was embarrassed further when the application was denied. Do you know why? The Marx family was Jewish, and the club was a restricted club. And true to form, Groucho wrote this back to the board there: "My wife's not Jewish. Can she go swimming? And can we let my daughter wade up to her waist?" But how is it any less absurd to arbitrarily ban whole groups of people from country clubs, communities, neighborhoods, churches, countries, based on things that we cannot control about ourselves, like ethnicity or whether we worship in a church or a mosque or a synagogue? When it comes to dispensing grace, Jesus cares not one whit about the history of your people. He doesn't even care about your own personal history. All he cares about is whether or not you are thirsty. Or more clearly, do you understand what you're thirsty for? All people thirst for something that will last, something that will continually renew us. We are like the woman at the well: "Sir, give me some of this water." The whole world is screaming to slake its thirst. The whole world is screaming to experience some hope. And instead of offering the refreshing hope we have, we tend to exclude people. We categorize them. And our exclusion often only punishes us. I have followed for a few years now the fascinating and hopeful stories of Syrian refugees. I was especially taken some years back of a story in the Toronto Star on March 14th, 2017, about a man named Tarek Haddad, I hope I said that correctly, who opened a chocolate shop in Halifax called Peace by Chocolate. By the way, they're still on the internet. You can order their stuff. The Prime Minister at the time, which was Prime Minister Trudeau, mentioned the business in a speech to the UN. And the Haddad business just can't keep up with the orders for chocolates. Haddad speaks of the culture shock of moving from Nova Scotia after 3 years in a refugee camp in Lebanon. He says that the local people were welcoming and he wanted to give back to his community by doing what he was trained to do, make chocolate. Even over the years, he sent prophets to help the victims of the Fort McMurray fire. Haddad states that he hopes his experience will show that when we accept newcomers, everyone wins. It's such a wonderful story, except for one thing. Peace by Chocolate isn't here in Simcoe. Good things happen when you and I, when all of us set aside things that seek to separate people. Remember the powerful image created in this passage? The disciples are trying to get Jesus to eat something. But Jesus focused on the work he was sent to do. The interchange occurs as the people of Sychar are just streaming out to come to the well. They're leaving their homes. And Jesus says, do not say, 4 more months and comes the harvest. But I tell you, look around you and see how the fields are ripe for harvest. This is not a parable, John 4. He is saying literally, look and see people coming to Jesus. What do we see when we look around at the people in our town? What goes through our minds and our hearts when we see heartbreaking pictures of desperate people on flimsy rubber boats or walking hundreds of miles, all in a desperate search for hope? It doesn't matter whether they speak a different language or they come from a different country or even if they have a different religion. They're all ripe for the harvest. They're all thirsting for someone, anyone, to give them a cold drink of eternal water that will give them some hope. Jesus said, everyone who drinks of this water, meaning H2O, will be thirsty again. But those who drink of the water that I will give them will never be thirsty again. The water that I will give will become in them a spring of water gushing up for eternal life. What could be more needful than that in every heart, in every single human being? It's time to offer this thirsty world the only source of true water that can quench their souls.